Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and this is the New Books Network. I am on faculty at Montclair State University in New Jersey, and I am joined today by Anthony Cronman. He formerly served as the Dean of Yale Law School from 1994 through 2004, and he has been at Yale since for over 40 years. He is the author of multiple books, including Education's End, Why Our Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life, and Confessions of a Born-Again Pagan. He joins us today to discuss his latest work, The Assault on American Excellence. Mr. Cronman, or Dr. Cronman, thanks so much for joining us on New Books Network.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
So this is a new entry in a long line of books in America critical of the academy. And these seem to have been periodically published since, I guess, the early 1980s. Why do you think that is, and what does your book add to the conversation?
Let me start with the second question, and then back up to the first one. My own strong sense is that in the last half dozen years or so, the political forces which have been filtering into academic life steadily over the last couple of generations have accelerated, have picked up pace, and begun to do damage to core academic values in ways and to a degree that wasn't true before. So in writing this book, I was motivated by a sense of urgency and the need, as I felt it, to respond to what was quickly becoming a crisis in higher education. What had been a problem for a very long time, but was becoming a genuine crisis. What explains these periodic cranky interventions of one kind or another, complaining about the demise of higher education and the humanities in particular? Well, many, many things, but I would emphasize one in particular. For some time now, the humanities as a discrete family of disciplines have lost the confidence in themselves that they once had when the rationale for studying and teaching them seemed clearer to students and faculty alike. That was true in the 1950s and the 1960s, really up through the time that I graduated from college, toward the end of the 1960s. But in the last several decades, the last 40 years, really, students and teachers of the humanities have become less certain than they once were about the aim and objective of these modes of inquiry and study themselves. And that, I think, has created a mood of anxiety among those who love the humanities, feel attached to them, teach them, were drawn to them as students, about what it is they're doing when they're pursuing the study of history or philosophy or literature or classics. That's been true for a long time. I think it is strikingly, disturbingly true today, and was, again, one of the motives that moved me to write this book.
So the humanities has been criticized from different quarters. At the collegiate level, you've had criticisms that were voiced actively or most notably in the 1960s with students who were at both elite and less selective universities arguing for changes in the curriculum. It seems to me, I was not alive in the 60s. I was born in 1970, but in of course, reading about this, it seemed to me that the tension was to what degree the students would be placated, to what degree administrators and faculty were willing to concede to student demands. But today, it seems that one of the, and if my interpretation of that is at odds with your own, then please step in. But it seems to me that today, one big difference is there's not much of a tension between the faculty and the students. In other words, there is a kind of an acquiescence from the get-go. Is that your impression as well?
Both yes, Ian, your second observation is accurate. But the first one about what was happening in the 1960s, I'd like to qualify in a couple of respects. It is true that student demands for curricular reform, of which we, you know, see many fresh ones, or it seems almost every week these days, began in earnest in the 1960s. Demands to establish departments of African American studies, eventually of gender studies, and the like. These were demands or proposals that first began to be heard in the 1960s. But here's the qualification. The student protest movement of the 1960s, in which I was an active and enthusiastic participant, was directed mainly at events and institutions off campus. Our two primary targets were civil rights in America and ending the Vietnam War halfway around the world. For the most part, we were content to go forward teaching and learning, learning as students, pretty much as our predecessors had. I certainly felt no conflict myself at the time between the more or less still traditional curriculum that I was following at Williams College and my student activism, which, as I say, was directed outwards at things and people and events in the world at large. Today, the students who are demanding change of one kind or another, for the most part, have in mind changes on their campuses themselves. Reform of faculty hiring practices, of student admissions practices, the reform of the curriculum, and so on and so forth. There's something very much more self-directed, even self-absorbed, about student protest movements today. But your second point about the alignment between faculty sentiment and belief on the one hand and student sentiment and belief on the other is very well taken. And I would say, with the exception of a few quiet and more tradition-minded faculty, among whom I certainly include myself, most of my colleagues are energetic and enthusiastic supporters of the students who are demanding more educational reform on campus. In many cases, they're leading the charge themselves. So students and faculty are allies in a common cause. That's true today to a degree that it wasn't 50 years ago. And the campaign for reform that they are jointly leading, if I can put it that way, is one that is self-directed at the academy itself and at the reform of its practices.
Do you see much resistance on the part of administrators, however?
Very little, you know, and even among faculty who regret this and fear that their schools are being run over by politically motivated movements of one kind or another that are damaging core values of higher education. Even faculty who feel strongly this way keep quiet and hide in the shadows and are reluctant to come forward and speak their mind because the culture on campus is run so strongly in the opposite direction. With regard to administrators, most college presidents today are career bureaucrats. They have grown up in college administration. They've made their careers administering in one capacity or another as deans or provosts, heads of departments, and moved up the administrative ladder until they've reached the peak and find themselves sitting in the president's chair at their college or university. That represents a significant departure from the practice a half a century or more ago. When Bart Giamatti was made the president of Yale University in the, I'm trying to think, maybe it was now in the early 1970s, he was a member of the Romance Languages Department and was appointed directly to the presidency from that position. He came from the faculty. He was not a career administrator, and he had a faculty member's view of the world. He had thought about educational values as a scholar, in his case, a historian and teacher of literature would think about them. He had reflected on the philosophical foundations of higher education at Yale and elsewhere. And he knew his own mind when it came to these matters. Bureaucrats of all kinds tend to be deferential. They're not independent-minded. They don't have many thoughts of their own. They follow directives. They implement plans. They devise strategies. They write mission statements. And all of that is really foreign to the old-time spirit of the scholarly and independent-minded college president who, knowing his or her own mind, could say to the students, you're wrong about education. You don't really understand what's at stake here, and let me enlighten you. But if you don't have thoughts of your own about that, you have nothing to say to the students who are pressing for educational reform. You have no ground to stand on, and so your posture will be deferential and conciliatory to give the students what they want in order to keep the peace.
So what does this then say about the role of administrators at all levels, from president on down, and the cooperation of much of the faculty, if not most? What does that say about them in terms of the character of modern education? I know that's a big question, but that begs for a big answer. But
yeah, it's a great question. And it's a big question. I would say this, Ian. The emergence of what I'm calling the bureaucratic president as a national phenomenon, this is no accident. It isn't that it just happened for no reason at all. It is a consequence, a reflection of the fact that our colleges and universities have become larger and vastly more complex institutions with many more moving parts to oversee and manage their finances have become more complicated. Departments and programs have multiplied. Fundraising has become a business unto itself. And all of that requires a degree of managerial attention that was not true, was not the case 50 years ago or more. So there have been deep structural, perhaps irreversible changes in the whole character and composition of higher education in America. And that has called forth, understandably enough, a whole cadre of leaders, bureaucratic in outlook and style, to manage these more complicated enterprises. I don't know what can be done about that. If I thought this were a blip or an accident or something like that, I'd be much more optimistic about the possibility of returning to a more value-directed conception of leadership in higher education. But the forces are deep; they're structural, and this is changing metaphors. This is a vast ocean liner now that can't be turned around on a dime. But excuse me. Having said that, I do think that if a half a dozen college or university presidents who fit a different model, who are intellectual leaders, independent-minded philosophers or theoreticians of higher education, were to rise to the top in a few schools, here and there, schools with enough prominence and prestige to carry some others along, I think that would make a national difference, just a half a dozen. But that may seem like a modest ambition. In today's world, it's asking a lot and more than may be possible.
So turning to the substance of your arguments in the book, you divide your book into four chapters. The first is entitled Excellence. You note that Yale promotes excellence, and you distinguish this from other perhaps end goals or values that universities embrace. What do you mean by excellence, and where do you see it? Where do you see other universities going?
Right. That really is the central question of the book, and I'm happy to have the chance to say a few words about it. When we use the word excellence in a restricted or limited sense, we have no trouble with the concept, and it will seem obvious to any thoughtful observer that Yale and schools like it are actively pursuing, cultivating, nourishing excellence in this limited or restricted sense. By limited or restricted, I mean limited or restricted to a particular activity. For example, the study of mathematics, or of Greek syntax, or of avian evolution. You could pick 1,000 different subjects which are taught here at Yale and other universities like it, and there are people who are pursuing those subjects in a serious and disciplined way, and some of them achieve great things, others don't make nearly as much progress. There are outstanding figures and works in each of these fields. Each of these fields has its own internal norms of excellence. And the job of the university is to provide the resources. One of the jobs of the university is to provide the resources that the participants in each of these particular pursuits or inquiries need in order to do the really excellent work that they aim to do and that some, not all, succeed in doing. But when we begin talking about excellence in a broader and less restricted sense, people begin to get nervous with the use of the term itself, and it becomes much harder to establish a meaningful connection between excellence in this wider sense and the educational program of Yale and places like it. By excellence in a wider sense, in a less restricted sense, what I mean, what I call, describe in the book, is excellence in the comprehensive work of being human, of living a fulfilling, rewarding, responsible, effective, and flourishing human life. That is a question of all-encompassing breadth. It isn't localized or restricted in the way the questions pursued by mathematicians or evolutionary biologists or students of ancient Greek are. It sweeps in everything. It's a question about the whole of life and what to do with it and how to get the most out of it and do the best job. That's an awkward way, perhaps, of putting it, but this is really what I mean. Do the best job of living as well as you possibly can. That ideal used to be at the center of the humanities, to return to the question with which we began at the start of the conversation. It used to be that teachers and students of the humanities said, well, of course, we're learning some very valuable things as we go along the way. We're learning what Plato said and Dante and Montaigne and Virginia Woolf and George Eliot and so on. But in addition, we are becoming more cultured, refined, curious, thoughtful, observant, respectful of the past, self-critical, and that all of these qualities are ones that conduce to living well in the overall or comprehensive sense that I've just described. Put differently, the aim of the humanities used to be understood as the development of the whole person, of the whole human being. And that idea is one that has not fallen completely by the wayside, but fallen under a shadow of skepticism and perhaps even disrepute. And the reason why I argue in my book is that it has an anti-democratic implication, which many people find disturbing and that runs sharply against the grain of contemporary sensibilities. We have no difficulty saying that some mathematicians are better than others. It doesn't trouble us to say that some classicists have a better grasp of Homeric Greek than others do. We have no difficulty ranking achievements when we're talking about limited, restricted pursuits of this kind. But when it comes to the comprehensive pursuit of living the best life that you can, to suggest that some get further in this work than others do, and that the point of an education in the humanities is to equip us to move ahead in the endeavor and to do a better job, not only than we would otherwise do, but a better job than that many people do in their lives, to be excellent in the work of living. And people recoil at that and say, are you suggesting there is an aristocratic class of superior souls, the beneficiaries of this education, who stand higher on the rung of being than others, and so on and so forth? And in my book, I own up to that and say that is exactly what I'm saying. I don't suggest, I'm at pains to emphasize that I do not mean to imply that excellence in living takes one and only one form, that there is a clear, discrete model to which we all ought to conform ourselves. Excellence in the work of being human takes a variety of different forms. I wouldn't say an endless variety of different forms, but a number of recognizably different ones. But I insist on the distinction between greatness on the one hand and ordinariness and banality on the other, and insist further that it is the job of the humanities to carry us as far as we can go from what is banal and ordinary and coarse and common into the realm of higher and more refined sensibilities, achievements, and characters. That's a really old-fashioned way of thinking about the humanities and describing them, but there is a long tradition in American letters of thinking and speaking about the aims of education in exactly these terms. And in my book, I invoke Thomas Jefferson. I might have invoked Frederick Douglass just as easily and well. And this has been lost sight of under the pressure, I claim in my book, under the pressure of the intrusion into the academy, into the realm of higher education, of a hyper-democratic sensibility, which insists vehemently, vigorously, at every turn, on the absolute equality of human beings in all fundamental respects. That's what my book is written against. I use the word natural, the phrase natural aristocracy, without embarrassment, in a very pointed and deliberate way. It has caused some of my readers to recoil in horror. I was cautioned by some friends while I was writing the book not to use the phrase for fear that I would turn too many people off. And I said, no, this is really what I have it in mind to defend, and I'm not going to be embarrassed by the hyper-democratic distaste for the word and the concept, which has put it in such jeopardy in our colleges and universities themselves.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that response that you gave. I want to talk about the hyper-democratic sensibility in a few minutes, but before that, I want to characterize your argument. It seems to me that this is an argument that if we were to place it in the time frame of political thinkers and philosophical writers, there's famously within the academy and has been made note of outside of it in terms of popular writing, the battle between the so-called ancients and the moderns. And this battle is between most notably people like Plato and Aristotle for the ancients. And the moderns would be people perhaps best represented by people like Thomas Hobbes, maybe John Locke to a degree, and also probably John Stuart Mill, who the moderns argue that there is this degree of depravity that's inherent to humans and that education can have a refining effect, but ultimately what we're trying to do is, in the Mill sense, we're trying to create the greatest pleasure for the greatest number. And there's obvious political implications from this notion of morality and human development. And what you use, the term you use, flourishing, is most frequently associated with the Aristotelian view of the ancients, wherein that there is something toward which we can all aspire for fullness as a human, but it takes a lot of work. And there is this ranking, as it were, of quality. And so there are very few people who will ultimately make it to that. And by the way I've set it up, I assume then that you might agree that you're more in line with the ancient view, perhaps, than the modern, or are you?
Oh, my goodness. That is the last question you asked was a large one. This one is cosmic in its scope. Let me just say a few things, starting with some simple observations and moving to one or two of a more of a more complexly philosophical kind. First, I draw my heroes from all periods and epochs in the history of Western thought. Aristotle is one of them. John Stuart Mill is another. I do think that you mischaracterize Mill in the sense that Mill couldn't get away from the notion that there are higher pleasures and lower ones, and that the distinction between them really matters when it comes to thinking about how to organize a social order. But I'm particularly attracted to Mill's libertarian ideal of free expression and free self-development. Burke is a hero of mine. I love Thomas Hobbes. I don't know that I can call him a hero, but how can you not fall in love with Thomas Hobbes from the first page of the Leviathan on? Among Americans, John Adams, Abraham Lincoln is at the very top of the list, Jefferson too. With respect to the broader philosophical question about the quarrel between the ancients and the moderns, and whether I put myself in the former camp, align myself with the ancients, perhaps with Aristotle in particular, the answer is only sort of and up to a point, and that if I had to describe myself, I would say I am a hybrid, an ancient slash modern, of the kind best represented by my real philosophical hero, Spinoza, about whom I have written another very long book. The book just before this latest one on higher education, an 1,100-page defense of Spinozism as the key to all aspects of modern life and culture. But here's the point, Ian, that I want to make. Aristotle emphasizes the centrality of human flourishing in his treatise on ethics and on politics. We should be guided by a notion of fulfillment as the building out, the filling out of our human, our distinctive human powers and capacities. And I'm with Aristotle in that respect, but not with him in another. Aristotle thinks that fulfillment comes in one, or I guess you'd have to say two, fundamental flavors: the philosophical and the political, and that's it. And the aim of living is to conform yourself to one or the other of those. What is entirely missing in Aristotle's philosophy is any sense that fulfillment means or includes as one of its components finding your own individual genius, as Emerson puts it, the distinctive quality of outlook, temperament, experience that sets you apart from every other individual in the world. That just doesn't appear anywhere, that thought, in Aristotle's philosophy, and I think ultimately for very deep philosophical, metaphysical reasons. So I want to borrow from Aristotle the idea of flourishing or fulfillment as the essential concept in thinking about how to live well comprehensively as a human being, but I want to, as it were, individualize that concept. I want to break it up from the monolithic form in which it appears in Aristotle's writings into a billion little shards, every one distinct from every other. And that latter refinement, if you wish, of Aristotle's idea is more than a refinement. It is a fundamental reworking of it in light of certain fundamentally modern ideas or discoveries, beliefs, however you wish to characterize them. And the result is a very distinctive blending of ancient and modern themes in a way that you find, to take a couple of American examples, in the essays of Emerson — I've mentioned Emerson already — or the poetry of Walt Whitman. They are my American heroes when it comes to the conception of self-fulfillment. Philosophically, as I've said, Spinoza is my landmark. And Spinoza's philosophy is an absolutely remarkable blend of ancient ideas, themes, commitments on the one hand, and radically modern ones on the other. So I think the phrase quarrel of the ancients and the moderns, though I completely understand what people mean by it, and it has its uses up to a point, obscures the fact, for me, the fundamentally important fact, that the way out of all of the dilemmas which that quarrel seems to create, to give rise to, the way out of it is to look for a synthetic alternative to both of the warring camps, which, as it were, captures the best of both and avoids their respective liabilities. That's what I tried to do in my previous book. That is the conception of fulfillment that's in the background of this one. Of course, this is a book written for a wider audience in more popular terms, and I don't get into the metaphysical weeds here that I do in my previous book. But the metaphysics of the other book, whose title is Confessions of a Born-Again Pagan, the metaphysics of that book is in the background here. At least it was in the background of my mind as I was writing my pages about the humanities and the idea of the fulfillment in the work of being human. That's a very long and complicated response to your question, but Ian, you invited it because you asked a monster of a question and gave me carte blanche.
Well, that's the task of the interviewer, is to throw you a curveball that you respond to eloquently and concisely. I agree with you. The Manichaean implication of the divide between the ancients and the moderns is a bit of a crude one, and it's kind of a shorthand that a lot of people use to talk about a variety of different distinctions, which are not always obviously black and white, and sometimes the chasm is not as great between the ancients and the moderns as is implied by that. So moving on to the hyper-democratic sensibility, you reference Alexis de Tocqueville several times in your work, in this book, and you talk about some of his fears. And so can you explain his fears and how they fit into your understanding of the modern university?
Sure. Tocqueville is the hero of the book. Tocqueville visited the United States in Andrew Jackson's second term in the mid-1830s, and wrote a book about his experiences and observations, which remains, I think, in many ways, the most perspicuous and prescient guide to American life, to the American mind, that anyone has ever composed. Tocqueville had a mixed reaction to American democracy. You might summarize it by saying that Tocqueville's view was maybe two and a half cheers for democracy, but not a full three. He admired the American democratic order, both on its political side and its cultural side. He described America, the American regime, as the most just that human beings had ever constructed for themselves. He was deeply admiring of the spirit of individualism, the pragmatic can-do attitude of Americans that he encountered everywhere he went. But not everything in America seemed right to Tocqueville. And he noted in particular that the democracy that he so admired had almost necessarily had pathologies of its own, pathologies that went along with its virtues and strengths. And he stressed a couple of these. One was the tendency of American democracy to level out or flatten down the distinction between what is great, beautiful, profound, works of genius and distinction on the one hand, and what is common and ordinary on the other. You might call this the anti-aristocratic implication of democratic life. And Tocqueville believed in the reality of that distinction between the great and the ordinary, and in the importance of preserving it if one wants to have a culture worth having. Secondly, Tocqueville thought that the spirit of American individualism, oddly, even paradoxically, it might seem, encouraged a corresponding spirit of deference to public opinion, to what he called the tyranny of majority opinion, to what the other people are saying, to what one's neighbor thinks and does. And Tocqueville explained this in an interesting way. He said the freedom and individualism of American life, which encourages each of us to make up our minds for ourselves, brings with it a heightened anxiety about what it is we really think and believe. That making up your mind for yourself is a huge responsibility. It's a burden as well as a gift. And many people, burdened by the anxiety, dispel it by deferring to the mob mind of the people at large, by conforming their views to public opinion. And Tocqueville said, if that continues too long, the people will stop to cease thinking for themselves, and they will become ripe for takeover by a tyrant or a despot. A thoughtless mob is just one step away from a plebiscitary Caesarist demagogue who grabs the reins of power and starts telling people what to think. So Tocqueville's dilemma as he viewed America was this: democracy is wonderful. The fairness and justice of the American regime would seem to him so impressive and worthy of preservation. And yet it comes with these pathologies. Is there a way to have your cake and eat it too? Can you have the benefits without the side effects? And he thought no, that they belong together almost unavoidably. Really, they did belong together unavoidably. But he did think that it was possible to offset or ameliorate the worst effects of what I'm calling the pathologies of democratic life by allowing or encouraging the existence within the wider democratic society of small islands, as one might call them, of aristocratic sensibility and endeavor. Places, institutions, groupings where like-minded individuals with a taste for what is excellent and rare and a fierce commitment to thinking for themselves, to independent-mindedness, might gather and shelter, as it were, from the democratic storm, and preserve in their own work a reverence not only for the beauty and excellence of older forms, but also the habit of independent-mindedness, which Tocqueville thought must be preserved if the larger democracy is to remain healthy or even to survive in the long run. And among these aristocratic islands that Tocqueville identified, he put our colleges and universities near the top of the list. And that thought motivates much of the argument of my book. I believe our colleges and universities ought to promote the spirit of independent-mindedness and a reverence for what is distinctive and great and fine, and in the souls of the young people that they are educating, nourish, cultivate a set of attitudes that might be called, in a loose sense, aristocratic. And that these young people, when they have finished with college and become productive citizens in the larger democracy to which we all go the minute we walk off campus, that they would possess the qualities of mind and heart and of soul that would equip them for positions of leadership that our democracy needs, if it isn't to degenerate into a thoughtless mob which flows back and forth like a fluid that has no guiding mechanism of its own, that they would help to provide some stability and direction to the demos, to the people. Tocqueville thought that too, I believe, or something like it, and many others who have written about the aims and responsibilities of higher education in the past have taken exactly this view. This was the view, for example, that Irving Babbitt defended in his book Education and Democracy, written sometime in the late 20s or early 1930s, and much of what Babbitt says in that book will seem hopelessly old-fashioned to readers today, but the heart of his argument is correct. Our democracy needs leaders who have an exceptional degree of cultivation, thoughtfulness, and above all, the independence of mind, which protects them from being just carried along by the latest opinion poll, and whatever other people happen to be saying.
So one danger that you've articulated that Tocqueville most eloquently discussed was the tyranny of the majority,
right,
and the tendencies in, of course, the most obvious application in American life, and it still applies today, is for electoral politics. In other words, who are your political leaders and policymakers?
Right.
But these islands of excellence in regard to universities, you are obviously suggesting that meaning universities, many of them have succumbed to no longer distinguishing themselves as protected, so to speak, areas wherein free thought will be allowed to flourish.
Yes.
And so that's a point well taken, but at the same time, it raises one question. Is that succumbing on the part of universities succumbing to a tyranny of the majority, or is it a particular strand of a minority view? In other words, what they've succumbed to, what they've embraced, that conformity of thought that in, sometimes is enforced legally on university campuses, is that a majority sentiment, or is it a rule of a particular minority?
It's a difficult question to answer. My concern is less about the takeover of our colleges and universities by the champions of a particular political program or ideology than it is by the politicization of higher education in general. Today, that takes the form of a hyper-democratic, progressive left, emphasizing an identitarian conception of politics and pushing its agenda on campus as it does off campus. That's the form it takes today. But that hasn't always been the case. In the 1950s, for example, the threat to academic independence came from the right, from the McCarthyites who were hounding left-leaning professors out of their jobs in our colleges and universities. The important thing from the Tocquevillian perspective that I defend in the book is protecting the independence and apolitical, non-political character of our colleges and universities from politicization of any kind, whether it come from the left or the right. It is the separateness, the independence of the realm of higher education from the political forces that wash over us back and forth in the rest of our lives. It's that independence which gives them, I'll put it a little differently, which makes it possible for them to play the special role in the overall moral economy of American life that Tocqueville assigns them. And once they become adjuncts to politics of whatever kind, of left-wing politics or right-wing politics, they lose their independence and cease to be able to perform that balancing or equilibrating function as well as they might and should, and that Tocqueville believed they have to in order to counterbalance the inevitable pathological tendencies of democratic life.
Another area that you are concerned about regarding trends in higher education is the what you describe as a vocational ideal. So can you explain that and the danger that you see that it poses to higher ed?
Sure. This is related to something we were talking about earlier when we were discussing the nature of the humanities and their special role in educational life. I think what I mean by vocational ideal will be intuitively obvious to most of your listeners. What I mean by it is the idea that one goes to college these days to acquire the skills and learn the disciplines and maybe, you know, form the, make the connections that you need to have in order to prosper in a career, to find a good, satisfying, remunerative job once you've graduated that will sustain you for some time, if not for the for the rest of your working life. People go to school to get ready to work, and in school they acquire the equipment they need in order to find the job they want to have. That's a universal concern and ambition, and I do not mean to deride it or demean it at all. It's obviously of tremendous importance to students themselves and, of course, to their parents and families too. But though it is a vital part of education, it's not the whole of it, at least as I think of it. Education in a college or university which claims to offer its students a liberal arts education is more than just preparation for a job or for a graduate school that will in turn lead to a job. It is an opportunity to find out a little more about who you are, what you care about, what really matters and moves you as a human being, and what you think you might want to make out of your life, not just in the working part of it, which is an important part of life, but not the whole of it. We all know that. What you want to make out of your life, all things considered as a whole. And that is the question. Now I'm circling back to what we were talking about before. That question, what does it mean to live well in a comprehensive sense? That's the question the humanities have traditionally set themselves the task of exploring. And it's fine. It's indispensable, even, that a student acquire the know-how that will help him or her after a graduation take the next step in life and move towards successful, satisfying employment. But it's crucial also that those years, those undergraduate years, which are so exceptionally free, freer than the years before, and in many ways freer than the years after, that those exceptionally free years be seen for what they are, an opportunity to do something that one they never again have the chance to do in life, which is to take a step back and say, whoa, here I am. I'm alive. I'm living. I've got years ahead of me, hopefully. What do I want to make of them? What do I want to make of myself? And by the way, who am I? What do I really care about? How do I define myself and my relations to others, my responsibilities, my convictions and beliefs? And if that opportunity is missed, it may not come again.
Well, that's that point. I'm
at
sorry.
At least it won't come in the it won't come in the same wonderfully open and free form that it does in the college years, when all of the vast resources of the student's college or university are at his or her disposal for pursuing it.
Well, that point is well taken. I remember when I was an undergrad and I was approaching my senior year and the major, I was a history major, and they had the prospect for a year-long, essentially a thesis for the senior thesis. And I asked my advisor about it, and I'll never forget his response. It stuck with me, and I've employed it in my own teaching now. He said, I would suggest you don't do the senior thesis. I was surprised by this because I thought it was something of a feather in your cap if you had done one and done it well. He said, you have the opportunity now that you'll never have again. This was him talking to me, to take a variety of courses, take those free electives that are otherwise going to be crowded out by the time right. you need to spend on your senior thesis. And it surprised me, but I took his advice. I did not do the senior thesis, and I did take classes that I never would have exposed myself to otherwise and might have missed out on as I pursued my professional career. But it seems to me that, you know, what you're describing really is there's a natural, logical, built-in tension when you go through, you finished high school, and then you're facing the prospect of 4 years in order to earn a bachelor's degree, and you're taking out sometimes a house mortgage without a house.
Sure.
And so you must consider, okay, in other words, I'm very sympathetic to what you've just described as these unique, enriching 4 years that you cannot probably experience as you grow older, but only fleetingly. But at the same time, there is this concern for job preparation, career preparation.
Of course. Yes.
And so there's this built-in tension that it seems to me just it's structural. In other words, you just can't completely eradicate the problem.
You're absolutely right about that, Ian. And I would say that the responsible course is for the grown-ups in the room, by which I mean administrators and faculty on our college and university campuses, to acknowledge honestly the imperative reality of the need to equip yourself to take the next step in life and to prepare for graduate school, professional school, for a job, whatever. But to make the case at the same time for the importance and value of this fleeting opportunity to step back and entertain questions and doubts that you may never have the opportunity with a comparable degree of freedom and with similar resources at your disposal to entertain again. Make the case for that, but in a way that doesn't, how should I put it, close its eyes to the obvious fact that the economic and material and other pressures that are on our students to find their way forward toward a respectable and well-paying job, those pressures are immense, enormous, and they can't be gotten. They can't be gotten rid of. I don't even know that one would wish to get rid of them if you could. But in any event, they're a fixture in our lives at this point.
So you have mentioned earlier that you got some advice from colleagues about how you, some warnings perhaps about how you ought to approach this. What has been the reaction of your colleagues, both at Yale and at other universities or in the academy in general?
Predictably mixed, which is what I had expected. I've had lots of cheerleaders, some here, others off the Yale campus. Many people have written to me saying, thank goodness, I'm so glad you've written this book. It needed to be said, and I'm just delighted that you did say it. I've had students here at Yale come to see me in the quiet of my office hours to say, you've given me some breathing room to express views that it would otherwise be uncomfortable for me to articulate in the current environment. And thank you for that. I've also been attacked in the Yale Daily News and elsewhere by faculty colleagues who think I'm terribly misguided and advocating a retrograde view which they see as illiberal and hostile to the great forward steps that our colleges and universities have taken in the last years. And I've responded to those, but of course I knew that was coming. It didn't surprise me. And in a way, I've been gratified by even the most critical responses, because it's given me a chance to reply in kind and to get this debate up into the daylight where others can, instead of whispering in the shadows, can express themselves and take a position, and we can have it out in the open, no holds barred. There's nothing wrong with that, with a good old fashioned robust argument, and without it degenerating into name calling and personal invective and the like, which it certainly hasn't here at Yale. So anyway, yeah, and I've gotten some flattering reviews. I've gotten some critical reviews. I would like to think that my critical reviewers missed the point of what I was trying to say. They would probably disagree. But again, that was pretty much what I expected. I would have been surprised, and I don't even know that I would have wished to be showered with uniform accolades that just wasn't in the cards. And I reconciled myself to the thought that if you're going to say anything about any issue that people feel deeply about and with respect to which there are profound differences of opinion, you're going to catch some flack. That's coming your way. So no surprises, and nothing so far that's thrown me badly off my balance.
So my last question is, you describe the state of the university in many ways today. What do you think, if anything, can be done to actually change the state of affairs to draw the university back into what you want it to be?
I'll return to something I said earlier in the conversation, Ian. A half a dozen thoughtful, courageous college or university presidents would make a world of difference. More backbone in the boards of directors of these schools would make a tremendous difference. And a de-emphasis on protecting students from the dangers of wounded feelings and hurts to their self-esteem and all of the rest of it, that would be good too. There's way too much of that on campus. And there's way too much of the siloing, of the breaking up into groups defined along racial and ethnic and gendered lines. Our campuses these days are wonderfully diverse places. They're just unrecognizably different from the campus I knew as an undergraduate 50 years ago. And that's great. I love the way the Yale campus looks with its diverse student body. But having won that victory, I don't want to compromise it by returning to a world in which people think of themselves first and foremost as Black or Hispanic or transgendered or privileged white, and lose so much of the ground that we've gained by opening our universities and colleges up in the last half century. So all of that would help, but let's start with a half a dozen college presidents who know their mind about higher education, who have thought about it, and don't just mouth conventional pieties, and are willing to stand up for what they believe. That would be a start.
The book is The Assault on American Excellence, and we've been joined today by its author, Anthony Cronman. Professor Cronman, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Ian. I've enjoyed our conversation.